If I told you half the things I've heard about this Jabba the Hutt, you'd probably shock me.
Hello, Blabba fans, and you are very welcome to episode 34 of Blabba the Hutt.
Illustrious Jabba bids you welcome and will gladly pay you the reward of 25,000.
So the only thing that you can tell me is that I will find Jabba at Jabba's palace.
If you're a fan of music, you've come to the right place as we come to part 3 in our composer series. So first you heard from Kevin Kiner, then you heard from his sons, the Kiner brothers, Sean and Dean. Part 3 is Nolan Markey. Oh, and by the way, we're your hosts, Kate and Gary.
Kate, I'm surprised we could make time to come together again for another episode with all we have going on for celebration.
Yeah, we've been busy with that capital B lately.
Mm-hmm.
Got a lot going on, but we wanted to get these episodes out before celebration, so there you go.
And this has been such an interesting series of interviews. You know, we are enormous music fans, and to have the chance to sit down first with the great Kevin Kiner was a dream. Then following that up with Dean and Sean, with the incredible work they've been doing and the incredible careers they've had. And to follow that up then with a very good friend of the Kiner brothers as well, in Nolan Markey. And if you haven't heard the name, Nolan is the orchestrator and composer for the likes of the Bad Batch, Tales of the Jedi, and he's worked on so many other different things. And as we previously said in our other episodes, the music of the animated series, K, has just been nothing short of spectacular. So to have had the chance to interview the guys in this series, it's just been fantastic.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, just another very cool down-to-earth guy. So that was another fun, you know, it just seems like we've been getting very nice people to interview. Very fun.
Yeah, and we're certainly not done yet. Let's put it that way. We still have a lot of things in our back pocket and some upcoming guests for which we still can't talk about. But yeah, it really is.
And celebration.
And celebration coming around the corner. We're obviously doing 2 live shows at that. So
plus whatever else we can manage to wrangle up, right?
Yeah, whatever else comes our way between.
We'll have our recorders like just anywhere in case we see someone interesting.
Yeah, I would imagine we would still carry our recorders in our back pockets on the off chance literally we get something interesting. Yes. Yeah, exactly.
Yes. Yep, that's it.
But yeah, I think people will have heard enough from us, Kate. Shall we just bask in the talent and wisdom of another of our interviewees?
Absolutely. Do you want to do the honors this time?
Punch it, Chewy. So hello, everyone, and you are very, very welcome to another episode of Blabba the Hutt. Nolan, welcome to the show, and how are you?
Thank you for having me. I am great. Really excited to talk Star Wars and talk music. So I've been really, really looking forward to this.
It's a really big thing for us as well. Both myself and Kate are enormous music fans, and it's something that we actually talk about in our live shows quite a bit, is we almost devote an entire section to music. And this became sort of prevalent in the last couple of years, where we knew Star Wars post John Williams, the music was obviously going to be a huge topic of conversation. And it's something that we've carried on with discussing the various composers that we would like to see work with Star Wars. And at one of our Dublin Comic Con segments, we actually did sort of a ranking system of who we think could potentially take over and who the dark horses were. But we'll get into that in a little bit, as one of the dark horses is somebody who actually gave you your start, I believe, and who has garnered a lot of praise for his work on God of War, which we'll get onto later on. But just to sort of,
I wonder who that could be.
I can imagine people are querying that. So if we could go back to the very, very beginning, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and what your actual educational background is?
Certainly. So I, as far as musical background goes, my parents put me in piano class when I was 4 or 5. I loathed it. I hated it. And then I quit as soon as possible. So by the time I was 8, I was out. But the nice thing about doing that from such a young age is that you get a very good sense of musical foundation. And then when in the States, in I think it's fourth or fifth grade, you have to choose sort of a musical path, or you did when I was that age. You have to choose either choir or orchestra or band. You have to pick an instrument, and then you learn how to play. And I wanted to be in band, and I decided to play trumpet. And my sister, who is four or 5 years older than I was, she was playing clarinet. I figured, okay, well, I better play trumpet, so every time she starts playing, I can just blast over her. Which ended up working out great. A great start to a musical career. But I really ended up falling in love with it, and I stuck with it through middle school, through high school. I did like marching band and orchestra, and then that's when I got into writing, because one of our sort of part-time staff members had given me a copy of Finale, which is a music notation program, and I learned how to write music on the computer. And then I ended up attending Cal State Northridge in Los Angeles, in the San Fernando Valley, so sort of North Los Angeles. Got what I consider to be a fantastic education there, and I made a lot of really really important connections for my career out of Northridge. And then that was my whole sort of journey. But I got to dip into a lot of different types of music. You know, I played in jazz bands, I played in big bands, I played in orchestras. I did weird experimental electronic stuff. And the nice thing about Northridge is that it's very much you get out what you when I was there, you get out what you put into it, and you can explore pretty much anything. And as long as you're putting a lot of effort into it, that you have so much support as far as your educational journey. And yeah, and now and sort of the full sort of full circle on the educational journey is that I teach film scoring and orchestration at Chapman University in Orange.
Wow.
So I get to sort of pay it forward every week, which is a lot of fun.
That's so cool. Love that. So, did you always want to be a composer, or was like when you were little, was there something you always wanted to be when you grew up?
Not really. I was until I was about 16, I think. I was much more interested in playing baseball than I was in music. Like, I really enjoyed music, but I was like, no, I want to go. I want to go play. But I think that's a very important time in your life. And I was listening to a lot of great music. I think around that time, a lot of really, really great movies were coming out, or great scores. They like 2009, when I was in high school, Avatar came out, and that was like just how that was constructed musically just blew my mind. 2010, How to Train Your Dragon, John Powell. So there was so much like what are now considered, I think, hallmarks of film music coming out around and then. And I was like, well, you know, maybe I could, I'm a pretty good writer, maybe I could do this for a living. And that was sort of the turning point. So I was unfocused as a child, but I think the closer I got to adulthood, especially my latter half of high school, I became much more seriously professionally interested in music.
Very cool.
And we've already had John Powell mentioned, so there we go. There's another big name thrown into the mix already. But in terms of your career trajectory, Nolan, obviously with what you do, you have to work incredibly hard. And you yourself, would you say your career trajectory has been fairly typical, as in you had your start and then it just completely shot up, or was there still a lot of hard graft involved? Because at the end of the day, you have worked on some of the biggest franchises in the world, and may we say, with some of the biggest names around. I mean, for those who don't know, you got your start with Bear McCreary. I mean, Kate is very familiar with my love of Bear McCreary. He is actually was my dark horse pick for to take over from John Williams, or to at least have him involved in the Star Wars universe. So, what was that career trajectory like for you, and how did it sort of begin and blossom into where it is now?
A really interesting question. I don't know if there's such a thing as a typical career trajectory, because you can ask 100 of us and we're going to give you very different answers. I mean, Sean, Dean, and I all have, when you talk to them, completely different experiences, and yet we've all ended up working together. But my career trajectory, it's been a weird one. It's very non-linear, I think. So when I my start was as an intern for Sparks and Shadows, which is Bear McCreary's sort of umbrella company. And I was there like because the normal internship period is like 4 months. And I ended up sticking around for like eight because they kept forgetting to fire me. But I ended up learning a lot because you go into an internship in a larger studio, like Sparks and Shadows or Remote Control. And the expectation is that you really don't know much. Like they assume you're a capable musician, but you don't really know the process of all that. But I was overseen by some really fantastic people. I was an intern. You know, you like interns are the bottom of the totem pole. I didn't interact with Bear all that often, you know, a lot of his team members, I think, speak a lot about the culture there at the time. And I felt as though I was just, you know, it's like in the Matrix where they download Kung Fu into Neo's brain. It was that like every day, but about music production. So I came out of there with a lot of knowledge at a really young age, which was great. My actual real sort of path into the industry came through Northridge, and it came through sort of two directions. The first being, so the link with Kevin, I'll talk about first, but I went to school with a guy named Jared Foreman, who at the time, when we were in class together, I think he was working at Universal. I think he was doing publishing or music licensing. Jared, if you're listening and I got that wrong, I'm sorry. It was a long time ago. I can't remember precisely, but we were in classes together. And when I was in college to just sort of get better at orchestration and writing, I actually transcribed like by ear. I wrote out all of Michael Giacchino's score for the 2009 Star Trek. And I had this big like 500 page, but it's here somewhere. I think it's in the studio somewhere. It's around. I can't think. But that was sort of my resume that I brought to, wow. I brought it to my interview at Bears. And I was like, look, I don't know anything about TV, but I did this. And they're like, okay, great. You're hired. Which was odd. I was overdressed. You know, I didn't know anything. It was a lot of fun, but Jared ended up working as Kevin Kiner's assistant. And 2014 ish, Kevin was looking for a new orchestrator. Cause I believe the gentleman he had been working with before was, you know, heading into retirement. And Jared remembered that I had done this book and he sort of hit me up and he was like, hey, are you interested in doing orchestration work? And, you know, I was still in school at the time and I was like, yes, wow, work, money, you know, actually doing stuff in music. That'd be great. I never even asked what or who it was for. And I just said yes. And he's like, okay, great. I'm going to send you like two or three cues. It was something off of Rebels. It was either late season one or early season two. And then I realized what it was, and I was like, oh, an immediate terror, you know, because that's when you're that young and you've never worked on anything, and they're just like, okay, great, Star Wars. It was a little daunting, but you know, you sort of just put that out of your mind, and you sit down and you do the work, and it turned out fine. I didn't get fired, and then we ended up having a larger orchestra session for Rebels in season two, and I did that. And it went well, and it just sort of kept on going for there. So Kevin kept bringing me back for projects. So it's been we're coming up. It'll be 10 years next year, I think.
Wow.
That I've been working with. Yeah, time has gone by incredibly, incredibly quickly. Yeah. But then the other big sort of path out of CSUN was I think my first year there, Neil Akery was guest lecturing in one of my film scoring classes, and you know, at the time everyone was, you know, because Neil was really well known for doing a lot of stuff on World of Warcraft, which was like, you know, the game. And but I was more interested. He had also worked on Stargate for like 10 years with Joel Goldsmith. I was a lot more interested in that. I was like, okay, yeah, World of Warcraft, I want to know about Stargate. But we ended up hitting it off. We're very much the same brand of nerd. Neil's a huge Star Wars fan. Like, he has a full size like Han Solo and Carbonite.
Nice.
In his studio, which is amazing. But then, you know, maybe about 5-6 years ago, you know, after being friends for a while, I started working with Neil as an orchestrator. And then from those two, like working with Kevin on the Star Wars stuff, and then working with Neil on his projects, things sort of branched out after that. I think after once you have a couple of larger projects under your belt, or you've worked with a few more people, you sort of get a stamp of legitimacy, and things tend to branch off from there.
Nice.
Yeah, that's my long rambling answer to a simple question.
No, that's great. So what are some of your personal highlights of the project that you've worked on?
Getting to write stuff for League of Legends was a lot of fun. Because I played it when it came out. I've for the last few years I've orchestrated a lot of stuff. Coming through Riot Games and help produce a lot of the sessions, which has been amazing. One day I just randomly got the email like, hey, we're doing a project. You want to write the music for it? And of course I said yes.
Nice.
And that was a lot of fun. So most recently that I'm really proud of that particular project, which was like the Winter Blessed, sort of a winter thematic for League of Legends. So I'm really happy with cool. How that turned out.
I have a question. It's actually not like technically on our list.
Go for
but,
it.
Have you ever been out in public and heard some of your music? And what was that like?
Yes. It's a little, it's not a particularly magical experience. depending on what it is. Because sometimes you'll be working on something, you'll be working on a project for so long, and it can, like what we do can be very stressful. And a lot of times when you get to the end of a big, you know, tough project, you're just like, I never want to hear any of this again. And there's always a cooling down period. But I've definitely worked on stuff ton of fun, absolutely loved it, but you burn out for a little bit afterwards, or at least I do. And I was sort of in that period, and what we had worked on was released like two weeks after we had finished working on it. And I was sort of still walking around like zombified, and I like heard it. I won't say where I heard it, but I heard it, and I was like, oh, God. And it just sort of like triggered the stress response. Man. But I think when it's a little longer, when I have time to decompress after a project, it's a really, really fun to hear stuff that I've worked on. Like I've heard people listening to like the Bad Batch soundtrack on Spotify like a couple times. I've heard stuff on like other people's playlists, and I'm like, oh, that's awesome. There's definitely sort of a period from where it goes stressful to where you're like feel very fond of what you worked on.
It's interesting.
So it's very it's specific.
Very interesting.
It is, and it's funny actually that you mention Riot, Nolan, because I have I remember I told you before, my friend Jamie, so Jamie Kenny, if you're listening, I am going to ask it. He is an enormous LOL fan. He is a huge fan, and as he said, Riot Games have had some incredible music compositions throughout their entire existence. Have you ever compared yourself to any of their composers, or what was it like stepping into that role to get involved within that world?
Well, I try not to compare myself to any of their composers because they're all really good friends. and they're all better than I am. But they're the best way to say this. I think Riot takes music more seriously than almost any other game company. They're dedicated to having everything be really, really great. And there's a lot of logistical support for that. There's a lot of artistic support, and there's financial support for that, which is really important. But all the composers there, you know, throughout the history of the company are just really the top tier people I think you can get. My bet is 20, 25 years from now, when we have a bunch of people winning Academy Awards and stuff, you're going to notice that a lot of them went through Riot. They have a habit of sort of magnetically attracting, at least for their staff, just some of the most amazing writers. And I was just fortunate enough to be sort of a contractor, where they brought me in, where their in-house people were just, I can't rave enough about how great their team is. But they're busy working on a lot of things, and they had a project come up that they thought I might be a good fit for. I think a younger me would have been an opportunity for self-doubt. But instead of, you know, I was just excited. I've been working with them, that team, for 3 or 4 years. Then they were offering it to me. They must have known I was going to do at least a decent job of it. And that's sort of, I guess the process of maturing as a composer and an artist, where where you have that confidence where you don't really think about that sort of thing anymore. But there's definitely, I love a lot of the music that's come out of Riot, especially for League, over the last decade or so. Because there's a playlist on YouTube that has like every theme like ever, and that used to be like sort of be my running music for a while. Like I just listened through all of it. So it's, yeah, I just try to make everything I write be the best thing I've ever written. I think once you get into the headspace of comparing yourself to other writers or what they've done, I think that can really only it won't be helpful, I don't think, artistically, at least not for me.
Well, in breaking that down then and further expanding it, let's go more into the technical side of things. This is the part that sort of fascinates me. So if I could ask you simply, what is the definition of a composer versus an orchestrator?
It's a good question. A composer is a person who just sits down and writes the music. The process of orchestration is part of composing. So orchestration is making the decision of what instrument is going to play what notes will go where within the orchestra. So orchestration is an intrinsic part of composition. When we're working at scale, like the actual job requirements. So let's say you're doing a movie and you have 5 weeks to do a movie and you have to write 2 hours of music. It's really not practical for the composer to write every single line themselves and actually do everything, because we've everything is pretty much written digitally now, and we have digital audio workstations where we play in with the keyboards. And you can play with samples and you can give these rough sounding mockups to the client, which is fantastic. But then there's also notation software, which is gives you the more classic, notes on a page, every line, you can see every instrument. That's what we need to record orchestra, and we need to pull out the parts from that. So the composers typically will work in the DAW, the DAW, the workstation. And then the orchestrators, in this case me, will take whatever they export out of their sequencer, their DAW, put it into the notation software and make sure that it's playable by an orchestra, by a group of live human people. And typically, especially like we're working with Kevin, I don't need to change a whole lot. He typically knows exactly where he wants things. And occasionally I'll add things or give him extra options, make a couple tweaks if depending on the size of the orchestra, just to make things sound bigger. Kevin loves big noises. And that's sort of my role, but it's a different, it's different with every composer, because some, Kevin knows the orchestra extremely well. Some composers are less experienced with the orchestra, or they'll do, less complete sketches or writings, and they'll turn it over to me and say, hey, could you sort of expand this out? So yeah, sure, because that's part of the job too. So it's sort of it's a job tailored to the expectations, the experience of the composer, and what they're mm-hmm. really going for.
Nice. So you talked about before how you could ask 100 of you like what your career trajectory was, but what kind of skills are actually needed to succeed in your field?
I can't remember who said it to me, but it stuck with me for a while because I found it to be mostly true. And I believe the quote paraphrased was, the music industry is 10% music and 90% industry. And that you obviously need a sort of a thorough grounding in music. You need to understand music theory is important. You don't necessarily have to play an instrument, but understanding instruments, what they can do is important. Being able to work on the software on a computer is important. But the things that I think really separate separating someone from who wants to do this as a living from people who have been successfully doing it as a living are the non-musical skills. Just in particular, where to start, the ability to take feedback and criticism and sort of fold that in, the ability to communicate with people artistically outside of your discipline, understanding film, understanding games, not just from a musical perspective, but from the director's perspective or the cinematographer or the writer's perspective, really, really important, because it's never going to be your project. You're always going to be telling someone else's story. And it's really the ability to look for, through their eyes into their own work is really important, because that's the only way you can really elevate it and help make it the best that it can be. Definitely perseverance. There are some people who have great, fast, early starts, which is amazing. And then a lot of people slog for a while. I mean, it took me a while to really get going. I had a slow few years, and then things kept exploding. And the last 5 years or so, I've been in a great place. But being able to stick with that, and being able to have that faith in yourself is really important. I'd say if there's any top skills, I would say it's those. So sort of the intangibles that that you need in order to stick around.
Cool. Great answer. So you say you don't compare yourself to other composers, but obviously growing up when you really started getting into the field and I suppose mastering your craft, who were those in your profession that inspired you and that sort of shaped you into the, I suppose, the musical genius that you are today?
such flattery. I try to draw from a wide array of sources. I obviously am in love with film music, which is why I do it. So I think some of the most, like when I was a kid growing up, I was born in the early 90s. So a lot of movies that came out during the 90s, early 2000s, really, really influential for me. Like two really important ones for me were David Arnold's score to Stargate and Independence Day. Cause I watched those movies a lot when I was a kid. I love Jerry Goldsmith, anything Star Trek. His score to The Mummy, the 1999 Mummy, unreal, one of my favorite scores of all time. But other than that, a lot of classical influences as well. I love Tchaikovsky. I love Shostakovich. All my famous Russian composers. It's really kind of a smorgasbord of musical influences, but I'd say in that critical period, when I was deciding that I wanted to do it for a living, it was really things that came out between 2007 and 2012, I think were pretty influential, like John Powell doing How to Train Your Dragon, Michael Giacchino doing Up, and James Horner doing Avatar, because that was when I was really getting into it, and I had software, and I was doing transcriptions and takedowns and figuring out how they were working the picture and how they were writing their themes, and that was so that sort of small slice of film scoring history is always going to be really special to me. And then there are a lot of modern composers doing really really exciting things too that I like to draw from. I'm sure the Kiners will mention Gustavo, but he's done a lot of just incredible work, and of course all my friends at Riot who seem to always pull a rabbit out of a hat and do something incredible and amazing and unexpected. So it's again, a long-winded answer, but there's a lot mm-hmm. that I draw from, and sometimes it'll be project dependent as well. Like when I was working on the Winter Blessed League theme, a lot of that was, sort of very wintry, chimey sort of stuff, and that was where I was soaking a lot of that in for a few weeks, trying to make that vibe happen. So it's project dependent as well. Things like Bad Batch, obviously listening to John Williams, but we'll have other influences as well that are best way, not non-traditionally Star Wars, that we can fold in and help to inform mm-hmm. the sound.
What would you consider the most challenging aspect of composing music?
Challenging aspect of composing music. I would say when you're at the very beginning of a brand new project, and there is no there's been no music written for it yet, figuring out your cardinal direction from that point. Because you're before you write a note on it on a project, you're at the point of sort of infinite creativity, which is incredibly fun and inspiring, but it's also a little daunting, because you want to figure out, you want to know how am I going to help tell this story? What's the most effective way for me to do this? You know, you want to make it special as well. Like, how do I make this special? How do I make this, you know, stick with people and emotionally resonate? And that's the tough part for me. But that's, you know, there's a lot of research involved. There's trial and error at the very beginning. And once you get past that point, I feel like it's very, the craft can take over a bit. Like once you have your themes and your palettes and you have a general idea of what everything is going to sound like, things are a little bit simpler. But I think sort of narrowing that creative focus at the very beginning of a new endeavor is what's challenging for me. But it's also my favorite part of the process. So two sides of every coin.
Yeah, definitely.
And kicking on from that then, you know, you guys work with so many different instruments, obviously the software packages and instruments and tools that you have at your disposal are constantly improving, changing and evolving. So at present, what would you say are some of the technology and materials would you say are your go-to when you're working as a project? You know, it could be simple as a pen and paper. Do you have maybe a software program on an iPad if something comes into your head that you can play around with that you need to jot down then and there? What would you say are your go-tos?
If I have an idea in the moment, the phone comes out, audio recorder comes on, wow. I start singing because I know it's going to, I'm not going to have it in 5 awesome. Minutes. It'll be gone. But in terms of technology, I think pretty much everyone uses the more or less the same stuff, at this point. It's become there was a period where everyone was writing, pencil and paper. And then, you know, starting in the 90s, there was this digital explosion. And for a long time, people had very different ways of doing things. And now, like, a lot of people are doing things the same way because technology has evolved to the point where things are much simpler. You know, with a lot of the newer computers, you know, you don't need, like, you know, 5 machines like hosting samples for you. I'm running off of 3 PCs right now that are all just doing samples. And I'm switching to a new computer, so I don't have to do that anymore. So the goal, I think, technologically is always to have less points of failure, to just have less and to make things simpler. Everything I use with the purpose of removing as many obstacles between me and writing mm-hmm. music as possible, which is been mostly successful. But I write in both Cubase and Logic, sort of interchangeable depending on the project. You know, we edit and mix in Pro Tools. You know, personally, I prefer to orchestrate in Sibelius because for me, it's much, much faster than any of the other programs. And I like the way it looks. And that's I think fairly standard, you know, across the board. That's what a lot of composers use. You know, the Kiners all use Logic. John Powell uses Logic. Bear, I think, switched from Digital Performer to Cubase. Hans uses Cubase. So it's a very just subtle variations, I think, on the technology we all use. A lot of it comes down to personal preference mm-hmm. and the little things. But you know, there's a guitar back there. It's an artistic guitar. I don't play, but occasionally I'll mess around on it when I get stuck. But yeah, that's pretty much it technologically. I try to keep things as simple as I can.
Cool. So here's a good one. Can you describe to us like a day in the life of Nolan?
that depends on where we are in a project. Yeah. So it's today, which is where I don't have anything. I don't have anything ongoing happening, which is rare. Today I actually slept in. I went to the farmer's market, and now I get to sit down and chat with nice. You wonderful people, and then this afternoon, I'll be writing on a personal project, nice. An album that I'm doing with a friend. But if it was like this past week or it was working, very different. Just because of the nature of what we do and the nature of schedules, music tends to be one of the last things that we do in production. So we're always a little bit pressed for time, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, but it can also be rather stressful. But so I think this last Thursday. So this last Thursday, I think I got up about 7, and I worked a 12-hour day. So I got up at 7, made some breakfast, just trucked through. I think I orchestrated like 15 or 20 minutes of music in that day, which was a pretty decent chunk. I just get through as much as I possibly can. And then just sort of call it a day. And the real everyone prefers to work different ways. A lot of people sit down, work for an hour, and then get up, do something, mm-hmm. and then come back. I have a really hard time doing that, because I'll get into a really great flow creatively, or just in terms of focus. And then when I get up, leave, do something else, and come back, it's gone. And that takes me a while to get into it. And I found that I'm more efficient if I just sort of, you know, park it. You know, I get up to like drink water and exercise and stuff, but I just sort of sit down, blast through as much as I can, and I find that to be more effective for me. Maybe I'll change my mind in a few years. But so far that works. But generally I like to set a couple goals for the day. I sit down and I really don't leave until it's done. And then I prefer to have something finished, and I can sort of just sort of take that out of my brain, leave the studio, go outside, and then just leave everything in here, instead of sort of carrying it around with me all day. You know, I've tried a few different things, and that seems to be what results in the best balance for me in my life.
Yeah, that makes sense.
It definitely does. And you touched on a great point as well. You said that you're always sort of constrained for time. So in an ideal scenario, everybody always wants to come in under time and under budget. So when you're working on a project, how do you estimate the time it actually starts from project start to project finish? Is that something you have control over, or is that something you're given by the powers that be, let's say?
Yeah, definitely. That's definitely something that the powers that be give us. There will always be a due date, you know, or a lock date. And there's a production schedule that's been, you know, codified into law long before I'm ever involved with anything. I personally love it. I find that to be mm-hmm. incredibly helpful, because if they were like, oh, yeah, just turn it in whenever, it will never get done. I would be picking at it forever, trying to perfect it. Yeah. And sometimes it's just not going to be perfect. It's just going to be done. And you have to make your peace with that. But scheduling wise, it can be so different depending on the project. Like I've worked on games. I'm working on a game right now that's been we're 3 years in to the music process. And in that time, I think we've done two seasons of Bad Batch and the one season of Tales of the Jedi, and a lot of other projects in between that are, you know, have much shorter production cycles. You know, be it for a TV show, for Vox Machina, which I work on with Neil, and for Bad Batch, maybe we'll have 7 days to turn around finals. Maybe we'll have like 2 weeks, like a much shorter amount of time, where you have to move through a large amount of music quite quickly. It depends, but generally speaking, I don't feel as though I've ever been given an impossible deadline. I've been given unreasonable deadlines, but sometimes as an orchestrator, that's sort of your job to help the composer figure things out. Because, you know, if they're saying, hey, like, I'll have all of the music for you the morning of the 24th, and we're going to record on the 25th, you know, I'm going to say that's not possible, not within budget. And I'll say, well, if you can get me everything by the 20th, like, then we're going to be okay. And then so that's sort of that's a conversation that can happen. You know, I'm quite fast. I have a team helping me now, so that if there really is no choice and we have, you know, 2 days to turn around, a ton of music, mm-hmm. you know, we can do it. Would prefer not to, because then we're all gonna be working 18 hours a day. But just being prepared for anything, I think is worth it. But, you know, for the most part, deadline schedules, pretty accommodating, pretty reasonable.
So we kind of talked about it a little bit before, but obviously you're working with some of these huge IPs, you have NDAs. And so what's it like working with these levels of secrecy?
It's not that hard, honestly, because I rarely, outside of the team, I rarely talk about this stuff. And the danger then becomes trying to remember what's been released mm-hmm. and what hasn't. Like, I'm not sure what episode of Bad Batch we're on publicly mm-hmm. right now. And then, you know, we're
faster.
Well, faster. I don't know. That's right. I don't know what any of the episode titles are, because we use numbers.
Yeah,
I have no, and that's the Teo one that just came out, which was
that was hilarious.
That was fun. that was fun character. Wow, my train of thought just completely derailed. Oh yeah, NDA is great. Yeah, that's a great question to forget what we were talking about on. No, usually not that big of an issue. Everyone takes it quite seriously. You know, it's not worth tossing your career away for like, you know, telling someone what's going to happen in episode 8 of season 2 of Bad Batch. You know, I like being employed. You know, and NDAs are there for a good reason. You want to, this is why I've really never enjoyed spoilers or having things spoiled for me, is because I'm a big believer in maintaining a suspension of disbelief. It is impossible to be captivated if you know what's going to happen. That's just my opinion artistically. But yeah, you know, you want to help maintain the magic, as best as you can. Sometimes though, like when you've been working on something for a long time, like I think there are 5 or 6 things that I've been working on over the past couple of years, that I'm dying to talk about. Yeah. Can't for a while. You know, then that just sort of, cause I've mentioned that to my girlfriend before. And then I always think of it as like, it's like an aging wine, or it's marinating, you know, it's, so it'll just be that much better when it all finally comes out. And, yeah, so never a big deal, with NDA. Like when I started hiring assistants, like I had to NDA them, and they're all very young. And I was explaining to them like, okay, I know it's like, you know, whatever, you can't post about any of this, you can't talk about any of this. If we're on a session, you can't tell people where you are, like that. It's, you know, we're used to it because we've been around for a while, but it can, I think when you're coming in, it can be a little weird. I remember I thought it was a little weird, when I first started working, but you get used to it. It's normal.
Well, from stuff you can't talk about to stuff that I have no doubt you would enjoy talking about, can you tell us a little bit about what the collaboration process is like when you're working with other composers or orchestrators? That must be one of the most fun parts of the job.
It is a lot of fun. I love working collaboratively. One, because it's less stress for everyone involved, especially if you've all been working together for a while. I've been working with Team Kiner for so long. I know when we have cues come up, when they want something orchestrated, I know exactly what they're going for, exactly what they want. You know, on the writing side, like everything is crystal clear. Kevin knows exactly what we're going to do. You know, every time we approach an episode, and a lot of that just comes from just really good, really, really good communication, really good leadership, a good system. There's a lot of mutual trust within the team, and that's the most important thing, is just everyone a lot of trust among everyone, and it's a dream scenario. And then I've, you know, back in the day, I've been on other projects where that wasn't the case, where you know, maybe there was the systems in place weren't as well, or there was, you know, unclear communication. That can be very tough situation to work in and do your best work, but that hasn't happened in many years, and everyone I work with now is just, I'm very fortunate to be working. I don't really have clients. I have friends that I happen to work with, which is the way I prefer to sort of think of my career. Yeah, it's just a lot of fun. You know, sometimes sometimes you have to have tough work conversations. You know, like, hey, like, I don't know if this is working, or like, you know, sometimes I'll get feedback and it'll be like, you know, this isn't really working. Can you take another crack at it? It's just, okay. You know, I think you need to experience ego death very early on into your career, in order to make it happen. But, you know, that's all part of the job. The goal is to make something really great and fun, and worth watching. And when you're working with people who all have sort of the same philosophy, dream scenario, I wouldn't trade it for anything else.
Nice. Gary,
sorry, I was just gonna say to you, had you got another question just before we move on to our sort of rapid fire?
That, no, that's what I was just gonna ask you. I was just gonna ask you the same thing.
One question that I probably will ask Nolan is, that before we get on to our sort of rapid fire question that we ask every guest that we have on, would you say there's any misconceptions or myths about composing that just are not true, or maybe over exaggerated?
Myths about composing. I'm trying to think about something that I see a lot. I think something mm-hmm. important to point out is that most because it's becoming more common for composers to talk about this now, which is great. Most composers, especially big composers working on a lot of projects, they're using additional writers. I come from the school and I've been working with people who credit their other writers, like Kevin, like Neil, like many others. And I think it's something that does bother me is the sort of myth that there's one person doing it all. And that, you know, certain composers sort of feed into that. And I'm like, that's not how it's done. I think it sort of does a disservice to everyone, by sort of perpetuating that. And that's one of the reasons I'm grateful to work with the people that I do, because it is very much a team process. It's very much a collaborative process. There is a boss. There is someone calling the shots who's the artistic head of everything. They're undoubtedly the most important person, but I think people will tend to, your team at least, will tend to put more of themselves into projects and love things a bit more if they're not being kept secret. And that's something that's slowly changing. The ghostwriter, I think, is dying a slow death. With more and more people being credited for the work that they do, which is really great. So that's something that used to bother me more. It's still a little bit, but I think in general it's like, oh, there's one guy like the tortured artist vision. I'm like, no, that's really not how it's done. Like, there's a team, and there's like a, management is a really important skill. And in a lot of ways, it's like any other job. Where there's delegation and teamwork and management and all that. It's the non-sexy non-artist.
It takes sort of a village, side of
composition,
right?
But it really does. And that's something I love, is like, when you see big composers being very gracious with their teams, like John Powell, who always, to my knowledge, fairly credits everyone and gives his assistants a lot of opportunities. Harry Gregson Williams, every single one of Harry's assistants, every single one has gone on to have a really, wow, really great career. Stephen Barton worked for Harry, and he worked on Jedi Fallen Order with Gordy Hobb. You can definitely tell who invests in their assistants, seeing their careers down the road. That's important to me. Like, I'm a teacher, I'm an educator. Just personally, that's how I feel. And, I have assistants too. And I like anything I can possibly put their names on, I will, because I think that's important.
Amazing.
Great answer as well, by the way.
Yeah.
Thanks. Things change slowly, but I was going to give some answer about temp music, but everyone talks about temp music. I think that cat's long out of the bag. So, something near and dear to my heart, but
that could be a whole other episode.
Mm-hmm. it's gotten so much better. It's gotten so much better. Like we get great temp, or the stuff that I work on. Yeah. I have no complaints. It's usually really, really good.
Cool. Hey, had you got one, or shall we move on to the rapid fire?
Yeah, I'm ready for the rapid fire.
Okay, shall I kick things off?
Right. Go for it.
Okay, Nolan. So no limits on this one. So everyone has their Star Wars. As a composer, if you could compose the theme for any character in any era, who would it be and what would it consist of?
Okay, I don't know if it would be a theme for a character, but okay, this is something that has been bothering me since I was 5 years old. So the original Jedi Knight games, so Dark Forces, Dark Forces 2, Mysteries of the Sith, they all use music from the John Williams original trilogy. It's all music edited in. I would love to take a fresh crack at that. I loved those games when I was we got one in a cereal. I got Mysteries of the Sith in a cereal box. and we got I think I got Dark Forces 2 when we got a Windows 98 nice PC. really kind of dating myself here. I would love to just take an original crack at those, because there's a lot of fun stuff, especially that I've been doing more stuff for games. There'd be a lot to dig into there, but Yeah, those games are near and dear to my heart. But you know, the canon was that's all Legends now, so it'll never happen. But in an alternate universe, that would be my choice.
Nice. So you referenced like some of the movies that have influenced you, the score and everything. So what do you think is the greatest film score ever made?
My opinion on that changes about every 20 minutes. Greatest ever. I mean, you know, you got to go with Star Wars, especially given Ridley Company, because it's the score. But I also have to go with, you know, at the risk of starting an argument with the listeners, you know, everything Jerry Goldsmith ever wrote for Star Trek, I think, just belongs in the pantheon, because I mean, he started writing with the motion picture, and then I believe the last one he did was Nemesis in 2002. And you know, Jerry Goldsmith is a composer who is constantly reinventing himself over his career. Like you listen to scores he's done 10 years apart, sounds like someone completely different for the most part. But those were hugely influential to me as well, just in terms of how important they were to me growing up. So I'd say those are two. Like it, best ever, I would say Star Wars as a whole and Star Trek as a whole.
We'll allow it.
Yeah, we are Trekkies ourselves. And to be honest, you mentioned Giacchino Star Trek. So that should be a very familiar face to you.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, I'll have to see if I can. I know that. I know. Oh, it's here. Oh, here we go. Okay, I found it. So I know we're in rapid fire, but this is the...
Oh, wow.
So I did this when I was in college. Cool. So it's every...
Now that is a binder, by the way. That is some size.
It is a beefy... But yeah, I did every single cue is in there. I did by ear, but...
Nice.
Yeah, it was. I learned a lot. It was great. It got me hired, so... Nice. Served its purpose.
So then...
Yeah,
I still can't get over that. And you said you did that by ear.
Yeah, it took me. I did it all by ear. It took me slightly over 1 year to do. And then I've done other. I did all of Star Trek. I did all of My Neighbor Totoro. Wow. I changed my answer for greatest score of all time, by the way. is Princess Mononoke.
Oh.
I said that's in my top three movies of all time. That was a formative cinema experience for me. I think I saw it when I was like 12 or 13. I was
blown away.
But yeah, I did that, and then I can't remember what else I did. So I've done three or four full scores just transcribed by ear, just to figure out how things work, or you know, figure out how to do things differently in my software. But yeah, I think I don't think everyone should do it if you're not interested in it. But for me, it was that was how I learned. So that's what I did.
So then, to put you on the spot further, do you have a favorite composer of all time?
Again, it changes a lot. I gotta go with. Like in the narrow race between John Williams and Jerry Goldsmith, I gotta go just slightly more with Jerry Goldsmith, and because of the way, like I mentioned before, of the way he sort of reinvented himself, and he was always looking to try something new and weird and different, and I think that's very. And the fact that he did it successfully, I think, is very admirable. I also like the Jerry lore, where you know he was at UCLA, but they wouldn't let him conduct or like write as much as he wanted, so he left and went to community college where he could do what he wanted. I'm like, yes, that's the, you know, that's the kind of person I admire. I've heard a lot of fun Jerry stories, because Kevin was really good friends with Joel. Jerry's son, and then Neil also was Joel's assistant for a long time working on Stargate. So via Joel, via friends that have worked with Joel, I've heard a lot of fun Jerry lore. You know, John Williams, I think, is going to be people always talk about Mozart, Bach, and Beethoven as sort of representatives of musical eras. I think John Williams is going to be
definitely.
If you know, 100 years from now, someone was like, pick a film composer, you're going to say John Williams. You know, that's the one. He's as they say, as the youngins say, he is the GOAT.
100%.
But if for casual, but if I'm going to listen to something, I'm probably going to pull up some Jerry Goldsmith. Yeah.
Awesome. So since this is a Star Wars podcast, prequel.
Yeah, I'm committing the sin of talking about gushing about Star Trek and Star Wars podcast.
But prequel era, original trilogy, or sequel trilogy, and why?
Oh man. I gotta go with the prequels. Because I was the target. I was exactly in the target audience when those were coming.
Yeah.
Phantom Menace came out when I was 6. Clone Wars came out when I was 9, and Revenge of the Sith came out when I was 12. So that was like huge formative, and just the music
yeah.
in the prequels,
yes.
I think is like absolute
duel of
peak
fates.
Stuff. Yeah. Well, I mean, we used to, you know, this was before. Like a lot of the playground equipment in Southern California was made a lot safer, so we like it was fairly dangerous, but we had like, you know, full like metal jungle gyms that, you know, on hot days you like burn your hands on and stuff. Great, loved it. But you know, then we had like my elementary school playground had this like long like hallway like catwalk sort of thing, like on the player. No, it would never zero handrails or anything. But yeah, like pretty much every day at lunch, like people would be recreating like the Star Wars. It wasn't like kicking each other off thing, you know. And that was those are important fun memories, you know, like people like singing music and that's so I gotta go with the prequels. Like hammy dialogue, yes, still love it. Like it's just so much fun. The music is great. You know, the characters are near and dear. So I gotta go with prequels.
Nice.
I'm a prequel baby as well, so I have to 100% agree.
And we got Clone Wars. We got Clone Wars out of the prequels as well.
It was a blessing in disguise, you know, for all the flack that the prequels got. Look what it expanded into, and probably, may I say, there are so many more prequel era stories that could be told. It's untapped in terms of what else could be on the horizon.
Yeah, I mean, you never know. There are a lot of really smart, creative, wonderful people. Formenting their ideas, and we'll see what comes up in the future. But I'm just happy to be a small part of it.
Well, you're more than a small part of it. And the last question that we have, but just before we ask it, we just want to say thank you so much for taking the time to come and chat with us. This composer series for us has been amazing, because as fans of Star Wars, but even more so as fans of music, it's been incredible to meet the guys behind the scenes who produce these incredible OSTs that, you know, will live on long after the series ends. So to be able to have a sit down with yourself has been an absolute privilege for us.
Oh, that's very kind, and it's the pleasure's have been all mine. I love to talk about this stuff whenever I can, especially with people that really love it. So I really appreciate you having me on, and I can't wait to hear what Kevin and Sean and Dean say. But yeah, I think everyone's gonna have a good time with this.
And the final question we have then, and I think it's particularly important to you as an educator. Do you have any advice for any young and aspiring composers or orchestrators?
Don't hang out with musicians. Hang out with people making other things. Hanging out with musicians will do you no good. we just sort of sit in a circle and complain at each other. But my serious advice is, yes, and this is what I tell my students, is like, get out of the music building, go to Chapman hosts Dodge College, which is, you know, one of the best film schools in California. You know, it's USC, AFI, and Dodge is up there, like top three, top four. Great, great film department. I'm like, after you finish my class, get up, leave, go to the film school, go make friends, because that's how you're going to work on stuff. And those are the kind of relationships that are going to carry you through your career. And if you hang out with film people, you're going to learn to think about film the way film people do. or games the way game people do, etc. That's the most important thing. But just make as many friends as you can. I loathe the term networking. just make friends, be the type of person other creatives would like to work with, and you will be fine. Everything else is just doing the work. You can't sit in a room all day and write and have things go. You need to be fairly social and sort of make the rounds and be a part of those circles of people that are making things, and just be the type of person those people want to work with. And that's sounds way simpler than it is. But that's the real truth of it. At least that's my experienced truth, I will say.
Great answer as well, by the way.
Thank you. But thank you so much for having me on. Yeah, if there are any other questions, I'm happy to take a swing at them. But
I have a question.
We covered a lot of ground.
So can you? It looks like you have like some soundproofing stuff in your background. Is that soundproofing?
Oh, yeah.
Like, what do you recommend for that?
So this is So these are all, move the camera a little bit, see. So I have clouds.
Oh, wow.
So it's not soundproofing. It's acoustic paneling.
Oh, okay.
So it doesn't need like dampen the sound really at all, mm-hmm. from outside the building. Thankfully, this room is constructed. It was constructed poorly, which is great for acoustics because there are no parallel surfaces, which is the worst. A perfectly like rectangular or cubicle, mm-hmm. room is the worst. Thing you could be writing in, because the bass builds up in the corners and the way math works with her.
Interesting.
Let's not talk about physics. It's just noon here, and it needs to be at least like 4 or 5 p.m. before I start talking about math. The idea of putting all the panels in is that it reduces the buildup of unwanted frequencies, especially low, like bass frequencies, which tend to build up, mm-hmm. in the corners. So that when I'm working off of my speakers, which you can't see, but they're sort of behind the screen here, I can get a much more accurate idea of what everything sounds
awesome.
Like. Because when you're writing, you want it to sound like how it's going to sound in a theater, and not how it's going to sound like in your headphones or like in a poorly balanced,
gotcha.
Room. Even though maybe a lot of people are going to watch Bad Batch on their laptops, but from the point of conception, mm-hmm. we need to make sure that. It's sounding as good as we can get it.
Oh, interesting. Thanks for that.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah. You'll see a lot of people use like these foam egg carton looking things. They don't do anything. It's a waste of money. Don't buy them.
Oh, okay. Good to know.
Generally, these are canvas over rock wool or fiberglass.
Oh.
Rather expensive. You can make them yourself quite cheaply. Mm-hmm. I had mine made because I'm lazy. But yeah, there's a company named LA Sound Panels that did all these for me. They come in and they do all the, like the physics of your room and stuff, and
whoa.
Then they design panels for you. But yeah, it night and day how this room sounded before and after. But
awesome.
Before we let you go, can you give everybody your social media info and where they can keep up with your latest adventures?
Oh, absolutely. So on Twitter, I am at Nolan Markey. On Instagram, I am at Nolan Markey. And that's pretty much it. I've survived this long without having a website of any kind.
Wow.
But when I'm working on cool stuff, most of it's going to be on Instagram. I'll occasionally post things on Twitter. But by the time I usually post things on Twitter, they'll be out into the world, with Disney NDAs and whatnot. But Instagram is the place to go if you want to see sort of fun updates. I post writing updates, sometimes little snippets from recording sessions.
You are on SoundCloud as well, aren't you?
Yeah. I'm on SoundCloud. I haven't updated SoundCloud in quite a while. I need to get on that, but I am on SoundCloud. I think again at Nolan Markey is the I have a thankfully a slightly unusual name, so it wasn't taken by the time I got on social media.
Nolan, this has been an absolute pleasure, and from myself and Kate again, we just want to say thank you so much for taking the time to sit there and chat all things music.
Well, thank you both. Thank you for having me. It's been a joy. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, it's been so fun.
Yeah, I hope you have a great time talking with Dean and Sean. Tell them
we
say
will.
Hi. And
definitely.
I can't wait to listen when it all comes out.
Awesome. May the force be with you.
May the force be with you.
Okay, so folks, Nolan Markey. We hope you enjoyed this interview as much as we had doing it. So, yeah, like we said, so much talent and just an all-around amazing guy.
Yeah, we've been really, really lucky with this composer series to follow it up with Nolan and to hear his stories and how he got started and how his career trajectory went. It was amazing to see. And I think what this series has done, Kate, is really showcase just how hard these guys work.
Yeah. Yeah, and I thought... go ahead.
No, I was just going to say the amount of time, effort, and dedication it must take to perfect their craft.
Absolutely. And I think it's interesting too, you know, like, you know, you talk a lot about different trajectories into careers. And so they all kind of have a slightly different path. But yeah, it's just fascinating stuff, I think.
It is indeed. And we can't say too much now, but hopefully this won't be the end of our composer series. That's all we can say for now on that matter. But for us now, Kate, it's full speed ahead towards Star Wars Celebration.
Indeed. Yeah. It'll be here before we know it. And like we said, we're literally going to be having our recorders in our back pocket. And we got so much planning still to finish with our live shows, which, by the way, will be the first time like that we're reunited on the Blob Alive stage in what, 5 years?
Yes, since 2016. So it'll be memorable to say the least.
Yeah, crazy.
And we're crazy enough that we're not just doing it once, we're doing it twice.
Good times, good times. So, yeah, we better get back to it.
Kate, I think we better get back, yeah.
Yeah. All right, so we'll see you all at Celebration then. And until then, enjoy these Composer Series episodes.
May the Force be with you all.